A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel wrote in from his apartment in Jerusalem, the one with the bedroom about 40 meters from a venue that runs DJ sets until 3 in the morning. He's hearing that low-frequency thump right through the walls, and he's been looking at acoustic windows. The quotes are coming in around $4,000, and it turns out most of what realtors call soundproof windows won't stop bass anyway. His landlord's not interested. But here's the thing. He's not asking us to validate a noise complaint. He's asking why the burden lands on him at all. Why is the person trying to sleep the one who has to engineer their way out of someone else's sound? And if we want cities where nightlife and residents actually coexist, rather than just tolerate each other, what policies have ever made that work without zoning them into separate districts?
The physics of bass is where this has to start, because it explains why the window solution is mostly a lie. A 40 Hz tone. That's the low end of a kick drum, the fundamental of a bass line you feel more than hear, has a wavelength of about 8.6 meters. That's longer than most bedrooms are wide. At 20 Hz, you're at 17 meters. These waves don't behave like the mid-range frequencies your brain uses for speech. They diffract around buildings. They couple into masonry and travel through the structure itself.
So the sound isn't coming through the window. It's coming through the floor.
It's coming through everything. The window is one transmission path, and for airborne sound above about 500 Hz, voices, cymbals, that clinking glass frequency range, a good double-glazed unit actually does meaningful work. But structure-borne vibration at low frequencies treats a concrete slab like a tuning fork. The wall becomes a speaker. You can spend $6,000 on laminated acoustic glazing with asymmetric pane thicknesses and a 100mm air gap, and you'll still feel that 40 Hz pulse in your chest if the building itself is coupled to the source.
And the marketing doesn't mention this.
The marketing shows you a decibel reduction number that was measured at 1 kHz. Speech frequency. At 40 Hz, the same window that gives you 45 decibels of reduction at 1 kHz might give you 12. Maybe 15 if it's high performance, laminated PVB interlayers, wide cavity, properly decoupled frame. But 12 decibels is barely noticeable. It's the difference between loud and slightly less loud. It's not quiet.
So Daniel's intuition is correct in the most expensive possible way. He's looking at a $4,000 solution that physics says won't solve the problem. And he's a renter. Even if it did work, he's pouring capital into someone else's asset for the privilege of sleep.
And that's the asymmetry Daniel's really pointing at. The venue externalizes its sound. That's just what a sound system does. The physics doesn't stop at the property line. But the cost of managing that externality is being pushed entirely onto the person receiving it. Buy windows. Buy earplugs. Move. Those are all costs borne by the resident. The venue's cost to mitigate is nothing in most regulatory frameworks. They comply with a sound level measured at their own front door, and everything beyond that's someone else's problem.
The earplug thing is worth sitting with for a second, because it's the advice that sounds most reasonable and falls apart fastest under any actual scrutiny.
Right. On paper, a pair of 30 decibel foam earplugs costs $3 and solves the problem. In reality, low-frequency sound transmits through bone conduction. Your skull picks up vibration directly. Earplugs block airborne sound at the ear canal. They do almost nothing for structure-borne bass. You'll still feel it. And Daniel mentioned something important. He's married. He and Hannah share a bedroom. You can't put earplugs on your partner. You can't put them on a child. It's not a couple's solution. It's not a family solution. And it normalizes the idea that quiet is a private luxury you purchase at the pharmacy rather than a condition of urban life that policy should protect.
The phrase that kept coming to mind reading his message was privatizing the cost of coexistence. The venue generates revenue from the sound. The city collects tax from the venue. The patron gets a night out. And the resident, who's also paying tax, also paying rent, also participating in the urban economy, gets handed a line item bill for someone else's business model.
Let me put some numbers on what that bill looks like. High-performance acoustic glazing, and I mean the real stuff, laminated PVB interlayers, asymmetric pane thickness, 100mm plus air gap, properly decoupled frame, runs somewhere between $800 and $1,500 per square meter installed. A typical bedroom window in an older Jerusalem apartment building, maybe 1.5 by 1.5 meters, you're looking at $3,000 to $6,000 just for that one opening. And that's only addressing airborne transmission. If the structure itself is vibrating, you haven't touched the problem. You've spent five figures on a partial solution that still leaves you feeling the kick drum.
And the stuff realtors call soundproof windows.
Double glazing with maybe slightly thicker glass on one side. 25 to 30 decibels of reduction at speech frequencies, which is fine for traffic noise. At 40 hertz, you're getting single-digit attenuation. It's the acoustic equivalent of putting a screen door on a submarine and calling it waterproof. The marketing creates an expectation that the physics simply doesn't support, and by the time you've bought the apartment and moved in and discovered this, you've already internalized the cost.
So individual mitigation is a dead end for anyone who isn't wealthy, doesn't own their walls, or lives with other people, which is most people. What happens when you flip the question and ask what the city can do instead?
This is where it gets interesting, because there are cities that have treated this as a regulatory design problem rather than a lifestyle preference. Amsterdam is the one everyone cites, and for good reason. In 2014, they appointed Mirek Milan as the city's first night mayor, officially the nighttime economy coordinator. His job wasn't to shut down venues or to tell residents to deal with it, it was to mediate.
Nightmare is a real title.
It's a real title with a real budget and real authority. Milan pioneered something called noise covenants. A venue that wants an operating license negotiates a specific set of sound limits, soundproofing investments, and curfew times with the city and with neighboring residents. It's binding. And the result, between 2014 and 2018, noise complaints in the Late Zeppelin District dropped 30%. Not a single venue closed. The nightlife didn't shrink. The friction shrank.
30% is a lot for something that didn't cost anyone their business.
It's enormous. And the mechanism matters here. It wasn't a decibel limit enforced by police with sound meters. It was a negotiated agreement that gave venues a predictable operating environment and gave residents a predictable quiet window. Both sides got certainty. That's what's missing in most cities. The resident never knows if tonight is the night the bass goes until 2 a.m. or if it'll stop at midnight, and the venue never knows if tonight is the night a noise complaint triggers a license review. The uncertainty is the stressor as much as the sound itself.
The certainty point is underrated. Daniel mentioned getting up early for work. The difference between, I know, this stops at 11, and maybe it stops, maybe it doesn't, is the difference between planning your life around a known constraint and being held hostage by someone else's schedule.
And that's a policy lever that doesn't require any new technology. It requires a regulatory framework that says, if you want to operate a sound system in a mixed-use area, you commit to a schedule, you commit to a decibel ceiling, and you're accountable to both. London took a different angle with something called the Agent of Change Principle, adopted in 2018 as part of the London Plan. The rule is simple. Whoever changes the status quo pays for the soundproofing.
Say that again.
If a developer builds new residential units next to an existing music venue, the developer pays to soundproof the building. If a new venue opens next to existing homes, the venue pays to soundproof itself. The financial burden follows the change, not the resident. It completely inverts the current incentive structure. Right now, a venue has zero financial reason to mitigate its sound because the cost is borne by everyone else. Agent of Change makes that cost a line item in the business plan.
So it's not a noise regulation. It's a property rights rule dressed as a noise regulation.
It says the person who introduces the externality internalizes the cost. And it creates a market signal. If you want to open a club in a residential area, the sound mitigation is part of your capital expenditure, the same way the sound system is. You don't get to buy the speakers and make the neighbors buy the windows.
What's the enforcement mechanism? Because I can imagine a venue agreeing to a decibel limit, and then not.
Berlin has an approach to this that's worth looking at. In their Kiezlocks, residential blocks near nightlife areas that get traffic calming and noise buffer zones, venues are required to install sound limiters. These are hardware devices wired between the mixer and the amplifiers. If the sound level at the mixer position exceeds a set threshold, typically 85 decibels, the device cuts power to the amps. It's not a suggestion. It's not a fine you can pay. The sound stops. The DJ can't override it. The venue owner can't override it.
That's beautifully brute force.
It removes discretion entirely. And that's the point. You don't need a noise enforcement officer to show up at midnight with a meter and get into an argument with the manager about where to measure from. The limiter is in the signal chain. It's either compliant or it's off. And if it's off, that's a license violation that's trivial to prove. Berlin has been doing this for years, and it works because it's technological enforcement rather than human enforcement.
The American approach tends to be entertainment districts. Zone all the nightlife into one area. Keep it away from residences. Daniel specifically said he doesn't want physical separation. He wants the mixed-use city where you can walk to the bar and walk home to quiet.
And the entertainment district model has real problems. It creates dead zones, blocks that are completely empty after 6 p.m. because nothing is allowed there except offices and apartments. It forces everyone to travel to the same few blocks for nightlife, which concentrates noise, traffic, and policing into a small area. And it undermines exactly the kind of urbanism Daniel's describing, the city where different uses overlap naturally, where the bar is on the corner and the apartment is upstairs, and both of those things are part of what makes the place worth living in.
The mixed-use city is the whole point. Otherwise, you're just building a suburban office park with better architecture.
Right. And what the Amsterdam, London, and Berlin examples share is that none of them solved this with zoning. They solved it with regulation layered onto existing mixed-use fabric. Noise covenants, agent of change, sound limiters. These are tools that assume venues and residents will be near each other, and they manage the friction rather than eliminating the proximity.
The other thing Daniel's question surfaces is that the standard dismissal, cities are noisy, move to the country, isn't neutral, it's taking a side, it's saying the person who wants to sleep is the unreasonable one. The person who wants to amplify bass at midnight is just. What cities do?
And that's a choice, not a law of nature. Cities are noisy because we've decided, through decades of policy and non-policy, that certain kinds of noise are acceptable externalities and certain kinds of quiet are private luxuries. Construction noise during the day, regulated. Amplified music at night, regulated but weakly and almost never enforced at the receiver end. The difference isn't physics, it's political.
The receiver endpoint is important. Where are these measurements actually taken?
Almost universally at the property line or inside the venue. The standard approach is, stand at the club's front door, take a measurement. If it's under the limit, you're compliant. But sound doesn't stop at the property line. Low frequencies especially don't. A venue can be fully compliant with a 90 decibel limit, measured at its own wall, and still be delivering 45 decibels of bass into a bedroom 40 meters away. The meter at the club says legal. The person in bed says this is unlivable. Both things are true.
So the regulatory framework is measuring the wrong thing.
It's measuring at the source because that's easier to enforce. You know where the club is. You don't know which bedroom window the sound is entering. But easier to enforce isn't the same as correct.
Which brings me to someone who's seen this from the other side of the mixing board.
They're right about the meters.
Go on.
I ran sound for a club in Reykjavik. This was 2002-2003. The venue was a converted geothermal plant, concrete walls this thick. The place was legally compliant. We had a decibel meter at the front door, it never went over the limit, and people three blocks away couldn't keep dishes in their cupboards because the bass would walk them right off the shelves.
Three blocks.
The sound was traveling through the bedrock. The meter at the door was measuring airborne sound at the property line. It had nothing to say about what was coupling into the ground and coming up through someone's floor 300 meters away. We were legal. We were also the reason a woman on Greta Scotta had to install rubber matting under her plates.
That's a perfect illustration of the measurement problem. The regulatory framework said you were fine.
The regulatory framework was measuring at the wrong end of the physics. If you want to know whether a venue is disturbing residents, measure inside the resident's bedroom. 35 decibels. A waited after 11 p.m. If the meter says over, the venue is in violation. I don't care what the reading is at the club's front door.
That would be politically explosive.
Venues would say it's impossible to predict how sound travels. It's not. It's just expensive to model. You do a site survey, you measure the transmission paths, you set your system limits accordingly. We eventually did exactly that in Reykjavik, installed tuned Helmholtz resonators in the ceiling. Bass traps. Big wooden boxes tuned to the specific frequencies that were coupling into the structure. 40 Hz, 63 Hz, 80 Hz. Absorbed them before they could transmit. The dishes stopped rattling on Gretiskata.
Helmholtz resonators. These are cavities tuned to a specific frequency that absorbs sound through destructive interference. They're used in recording studios and concert halls. Putting them in a nightclub ceiling as a structural mitigation for the neighborhood is, that's clever.
Cost about $12,000 in 2003. The venue paid. It was cheaper than fighting noise complaints for the next decade.
And you still have the schematics.
Somewhere in the garage. It's not complicated. You calculate the target frequency, you build a box with a port tuned to that wavelength, you line it with absorption. The hard part is knowing which frequencies are the problem. That takes a measurement microphone and about 20 minutes.
The question this raises is whether something like that could be a building code requirement for new venues. If you're going to operate amplified sound in a mixed-use area, you install bass trapping tuned to the structure's resonance frequencies as part of your build-out. Make it a condition of the license.
That's what we ended up doing voluntarily. The city never required it. We just got tired of the complaints.
So the technical solutions exist. The question is whether we have the political appetite for them.
That's really where Daniel's question lands. He's not asking whether physics can solve this. Physics can solve it. Bass traps, sound limiters, decoupled slabs, receiver side measurement standards, the toolkit exists. The barrier isn't technical. It's that we've decided, as a matter of policy in most cities, that the person trying to sleep should bear the cost of someone else's sound. Reversing that requires a political choice.
The agent of change principle is the cleanest expression of that choice. You change the status quo. You pay for the mitigation. It doesn't matter whether you're a developer or a club owner or a resident. The cost follows the decision. And what's striking is how few cities have adopted it. London did in 2018. Most places haven't.
Part of the resistance is that venues argue it'd kill nightlife. The Amsterdam data suggests otherwise. 30% fewer complaints, zero venue closures. The nightmare model didn't eliminate nightlife. It gave it a predictable operating environment. Venues knew what their limits were and could plan around them. Residents knew when the sound would stop and could plan around that. The uncertainty was the conflict driver, and the covenant removed the uncertainty.
There's also a question Daniel didn't ask directly, but that sits underneath his whole prompt. Would residents accept the trade-offs these policies require? Stricter venue licensing means fewer spontaneous events. Sound limiters mean a DJ can't push the system when the crowd wants more. Receiver-side standards mean venues might have to operate at lower levels than they'd prefer. These are real costs to nightlife culture.
The alternative is the status quo, where residents bear the cost in sleep, health, and money. The question isn't whether there are trade-offs, it's who makes them. Right now, the resident makes all of them, and the venue makes none. A balanced policy doesn't mean no one sacrifices anything. It means the sacrifice is distributed.
There's a health dimension here, too, that we haven't touched. Chronic low-frequency noise exposure, even at levels that don't wake you up, elevates cortisol. It fragments sleep architecture. You spend less time in deep sleep and REM, even if you don't consciously register waking up. Over months and years, that's linked to hypertension, cognitive impairment, cardiovascular stress. This isn't just an amenity question. It's a public health question.
The World Health Organization's noise guidelines for Europe, updated in 2018, recommend nighttime noise levels below 40 decibels, a weighted outside bedrooms to protect sleep. For low-frequency noise specifically, the evidence suggests even lower thresholds may be necessary because of that bone conduction pathway we talked about. Your ears might be blocked, but your body is still registering the vibration. And most urban residents near nightlife are experiencing levels well above that multiple nights per week.
When someone says just wear earplugs, they're offering a partial solution to part of the problem and calling it done. The earplugs don't stop structure-borne bass, and they don't stop the physiological stress response even if they did.
The policy models we've been discussing. Amsterdam's Noise Covenants, London's Agent of Change, Berlin's Sound Limiters, none of them are perfect. They all require enforcement infrastructure. They all create compliance costs for venues. They all involve government mediating between competing private interests in a way that's politically fraught. But they share something important. They treat noise as a regulatory problem rather than a lifestyle preference. They start from the premise that quiet is a legitimate claim on urban space, not a luxury you purchase or a killjoy impulse you suppress.
Daniel's question ultimately comes down to who gets to define what a city is for. Is it a place where commerce and entertainment can externalize their costs onto residents without consequence? Or is it a place where different uses, living, working, playing, negotiate their coexistence through rules that distribute the burden fairly? Acoustic windows can't answer that question. It's a question about power and cost and whose comfort matters in the design of urban space.
The open question I keep coming back to is whether the political will exists to adopt these policies outside of the few cities that have already done it. Amsterdam had a specific problem. The Leidseplein district was generating complaints at a rate that threatened the nightlife economy itself. The nightmare was a response to a crisis. London's Agent of Change was a response to venues closing because new residents complained about noise that predated them. Berlin's Kiezblocks emerged from a decades-long squatters' rights and alternative culture tradition that gave residents unusual political leverage. These policies weren't adopted because someone read a white paper and thought they were elegant. They were adopted because the status quo became unsustainable.
Daniel's Jerusalem. A city with dense stone construction, narrow streets that act as sound canyons, a culture that values both vibrant nightlife and family life in close proximity, has all the conditions that made those crises elsewhere. The question is whether it takes a crisis to act.
The physics doesn't care about the politics. 40 Hertz bass will travel through Jerusalem limestone the same way it travels through Reykjavik basalt. The solutions are known. The cost of implementing them is quantifiable. What's missing is the regulatory imagination to say the person trying to sleep isn't the problem.
Producer credit to Hilad Flumingtop, who apparently has bass trap schematics in his garage and a story for every frequency on the spectrum.
This has been My Weird Prompts, the Human AI Collaboration Podcast. If you've got a question about urban life that's been keeping you up, literally or otherwise, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. Until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.